Welcome to ICOSA's Driving Force Radio, where we discover what drives today's leaders. Now, here's your host, Jan Mazzotti.
Good morning and welcome to Driving Force Radio, where we seek to discover what drives today's leaders. On today's show is my co-host, Kelly De La Torre, the founder and CEO of Rapid Tech Transit, as well as Women in Energy, based here in Denver, Colorado. Welcome to the show, Kelly.
Thanks for having me, Jan.
Kelly, we have a fantastic show today, and we're going to be talking about green jobs, yes?
Yeah, this is a really hot topic right now, especially in this election season, in a time that we're trying to create jobs in the economy. And so we're very excited today to be talking to one of the recognized experts in this field, Nancy Fund.
And we're really going to kind of delve into how governors from both political parties have sort of embraced or not embraced clean tech as an economic driver in their states as part of this conversation.
It's really interesting to me that these political leaders at the local and state levels have recognized the importance of clean tech in growing the economy, where there's some sort of disconnect at the federal level.
Yeah, and Nancy Fund is a managing partner of DBL Investors based out of San Francisco. She writes frequently on matters relating to clean tech and impact investing, and she's here to really talk about some of those issues. She's written a paper called What Would Jefferson Do?, as well as recently released the report Red, White, and Green, The True Colors of America's Clean Tech Jobs. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Nancy, DBL Investors is known for investing in these clean technologies. Could you talk a little bit about the philosophy behind DBL Investors and the trends that you're seeing?
Sure. DBL Investors, the DBL stands for double bottom line. And what that means is that we invest for both to optimize both the first bottom line, which is, of course, financial performance. But we don't stop there. We also go for the second bottom line, which is social, environmental, and economic progress in the regions in which we invest. And we've been doing this now since about 2004 and really have proof that you don't have to sacrifice one for the other, and that you can actually develop, with the right approach, companies that both meet the return expectations of their investors, but also really make a big difference in society. And of course, clean tech companies are one of the ways to do that most explicitly, because you're building companies, you're creating jobs, and you're helping the environment and helping the United States develop more energy independence.
Well, Nancy, you talk a lot about this double bottom line, or you've mentioned it. How does positive social change and a healthy financial performance connect? What does that mean? I think people hear that a lot, or a triple bottom line approach. How does that really connect? How do you measure that?
Good question, because measurement is really at the core of what we do. The first bottom line you measure by your internal rate of return, called the IRR, which every venture capitalist uses as a metric. And we are a top quartile fund, which means that we're in the top 25% of funds of our year when we started. So that's how you measure financial performance. And of course, if you don't do that, then the rest doesn't hang together, because if you don't build successful companies across a portfolio, not every company has to be a winner, but you have to have those returns in order to grow your field and raise another fund. So that's where it all starts. But then on the social side, you can, for example, one of our companies that we invested in many years ago was Tesla Motors, the electric vehicle company.
Sure.
And that has been a great investment, as well as redefining the car industry for the 21st century and reducing and eliminating the carbon footprint of cars, as long as their electricity source is not from coal, of course, but at any rate, reducing significantly the dependence on oil for car transportation, which is a huge both social and environmental and political benefit.
Given the philosophy of DBL Investors, it's easy to see how you would be perfectly positioned to put out a report like Red, White, and Green. Can you talk a little bit about how that report came about, and was it based on that you were started to see these trends, or what was the impetus behind that?
Well, it's interesting. We did that. The red, white, and green report really shows that green jobs are growing everywhere, not just in blue states. And in fact, they're growing. Some of the fastest growing clean tech job states are red states or swing states. And the reason we did it is because, unless you've been on another planet for the past 12 months, clean tech has become incredibly polarizing as a political issue, and it really has turned into something that is a political football during this election season. And when you're in the trenches trying to grow these companies, that isn't particularly helpful. And so we were trying to see, well, let's really examine clean tech jobs and see if they are so partisan. And what we found surprised us, that they're not partisan at all, and in fact, these jobs are just as beneficial to people in red states as in blue.
You know, I think that's so interesting, because here at ICOSA, really our core fundamental belief is really around how can we connect change makers with other change makers and bring it together and continue to make change and move forward. And so I love that premise that jobs aren't really partisan. These green jobs aren't partisan. They are an economic driver for states, whether you're red, blue, purple, whatever color you are. And I think it's interesting, too, that locally, governors and state and national leaders are seeing it at the governor's level. But then when you get to Washington, when you get inside the Beltway, it sort of seems to get lost, or it seems to become very divisive. And so how do we get the message to Washington as local leaders and as state leaders to drive the message forward that these can be really good, solid economic drivers? They can be job creators for your state. I know here in Colorado, we've had huge direct investment and foreign direct investment as well in clean jobs, but yet we're seeing it pull back and we're seeing layoffs time and again in these clean sectors.
Right. Well, it's a complex process to go from state activity to federal, but what we suggested in the report was that clearly some of the nation's leading Republican governors, Christie in New Jersey, Perry in Texas, Brownback in Kansas, Bobby Jindal in Louisiana, they did not get the memo that clean tech is controversial. They're out there inviting companies to the state, promoting policies that support renewables and energy efficiency. And what we found is that it's because governors are more pragmatic. They have to show that they're doing something for their state and for the citizens of their state, or else they won't get reelected. So they take a very bipartisan or nonpartisan view to clean tech when they're actually in the state house doing their job. It's only when you get to Washington and you're on the talk show circuit or on the congressional floor that the rhetoric seeps in and really dominates the conversation, as opposed to the positive, constructive aspects of clean tech. And so what we need to do in order to shift that dynamic is really to, and we said it in the report, is to show that increasingly the people that are voting for politicians will be employed at a certain level by clean tech. And people that have jobs tend to vote. And so at your own political risk, will you trash clean tech going forward? Because that may be a significant component of your electorate. And so that will help keep some of the dialogue going forward less high-pitched and more pragmatic is what we hope.
That makes a lot of sense. Before we dive into more of the details of the report, I just, and you note also in the report that there's this question about how you define green jobs or clean tech. And I noticed that in preparing for this over the past several weeks, this conversation with you, I noticed that a lot of the comments to the articles that are posted on some of these news magazines, electronic news magazines, mention that, well, the definition's so broad that it can't be, that it skews the results. But you take pains in the report to define that, green jobs and clean tech, so that it does make an impact. So could you explain that a little?
First off, in an era where in many of our states we have double-digit unemployment, I think quabbling about whether a job counts as clean, as green or not is a little off the mark, because we need jobs of all stripes.
Right.
And whether or not someone's working for the Park Service in Alaska versus working for a solar company in Arizona, that really shouldn't matter. That there's a huge need for jobs that relate to natural resources as well as to renewables and energy efficiency. So I don't really buy the kind of harping on what is a clean job or not. Having said that, we did not use the Bureau of Labor Statistics number because they had been challenged in the press when they came out. What we did is we went to Brookings, which had responded to the criticism of the BLS and said, okay, we're going to chop some of those numbers and not be as broad. And so we used the Brookings numbers, which had already given a haircut to the government numbers, and we left it at that. You know, we're not professors. You know, we do have a day job, and so we really can't go around counting these ourselves.
Right.
But Brookings is obviously a very well-regarded think tank and had already done that haircutting for us.
Well, and when you talk about that and you define the green jobs, I guess my question really is what does that mean in the whole scheme of things? You know, we know that coal sector is defined its way and the oil and gas sector is defined its way, and then the clean sector is its own way. But I guess my question is how do we level this playing field and this definition as we have these discussions? Because what we're seeing, especially here in our Western states, is that so many of these jobs can't really be defined, or they're not being defined that way.
Yeah, I guess I would suggest to people that they not obsess about the number of green jobs and look more at the growth rates, which are very, very healthy. Because let's face it, it's a young industry. I mean, back in the 70s when biotech companies got started, they didn't employ many people. And now biotech is a very thriving part of the pharmaceutical industry. It takes a while to get these numbers to be huge. But directionally, if you look at the growth rates, that's what you want to see. And in solar alone, we point out in the report, the growth rate in solar jobs over the past period of time has been almost an order of magnitude above the overall growth in employment as a nation. So let's focus on that. At a time when it's been very hard for the nation to create jobs, solar and other parts of clean tech have been really acing it.
The part where I see the intersection getting very complex is, one, are we comparing apples to apples when we compare the growth in oil and gas and the growth in clean tech, in that, like you mentioned, oil and gas and coal, they were not economic energy resources until there was government support for them. And now, where we stand today, we can see the outcome of that. We can see that those are very necessary resources to us right now because we haven't transitioned, and they're economical. But we can't see the end result of the clean technology. So what do we need to do to level the playing field? Do we need to look at the emissions that come from conventional fuels and somehow incorporate that in the value? Or how can we make sure that this is just like the failure to really address the PTC right now? Is that just a blip? Or how do we smooth out these transitions?
Right. Well, there are a lot of questions in that.
Yeah, it's so complicated.
One of the other studies we did, What Would Jefferson Do?, which looks at the history of energy subsidies. There is no controversy over the fact that our nation has always subsidized new energy sources. And that's what this report shows. And we're not the only ones. It's, you know, if you Google energy subsidies, you'll find a huge body of work on this. And the point is that energy sources are important to our nation. They've helped to fuel our economic growth over centuries. And so it isn't at all surprising that we have helped new energy sources emerge and thrive and grow. And we started doing that as early as wood. You know, back in when wood was a source of power, there were all kinds of land grants that weren't dedicated to energy, but were beneficial to those that wanted to dominate that particular energy source at the time. And then you have coal came in the 19th century, and all kinds of subsidies and policies to encourage coal development. And then in the early 20th century, you had oil come on the scene and derive significant subsidies and eventually tax treatments that are specific to that industry that help it compete. And then, of course, nuclear in the middle of the 20th century also got its fair of support. And then when renewables came along with the investment tax credit, that is obviously a way to promote that source of energy. But it isn't an aberration. That's the point. It is part of a tradition that's as American as apple pie. And the subsidies that are going to renewables are far less than what oil and gas and nuclear enjoyed in their early days. And in that paper, we get into that. In the first 15 years for oil and gas, those subsidies were five times greater than what renewables gets in its first 15 years. And for nuclear, it was 10 times greater. So let's just accept that it's been our policy to help these new energy sources compete. But now the issue is that the oil and gas and nuclear subsidies are kind of the gift that keeps on giving, because many of these tax provisions exist today, even when these are the dominant incumbent sources of energy. So in terms of what would make it easier, certainly a price on carbon would level the playing field. And that's why across the globe, there have been efforts to analyze that and policies that reflect that. The U.S. is not there yet. We're going to see California with its cap and trade regime coming in later this year. We'll have a big state that will be putting a price indirectly on carbon. And of course, we have other in the Northeast, they've been doing this. So we do have pockets of that activity, and that will help to show that the external costs of some of our fossil fuels really add significantly to its cost. And of course, you're seeing that in coal, where the kinds of restrictions and emissions requirements and laws are really making it more expensive for coal to compete right now. And then just finally, your question about the boom and bust, the production tax credit that is putting a damper on wind right now because it expires at the end of the year. We need longer term horizons. We need visibility. As an investor, the first thing I'll tell you is that if I don't have some visibility over, 5 to 10 years in terms of where things are headed, it's very difficult to make good investments, because you make an investment, you build upon that, and good companies don't appear overnight. They're the result of a lot of hard work that happens over many years. So the production tax credit is very important. And, I'm not a politician, but it seems to me that it's got caught up in the campaign rhetoric. And what some people feel is that, as usual, at the last possible minute, an extension of it might be thrown into a bill and we'll get some relief. But clearly the damage is already being done, because you're seeing projects, people step away from projects, you're seeing employment numbers come down. So it's very important to get this right.
Absolutely. And I want to come back to something that you talked about. And you said the way to level the playing field is really to put this price on carbon. And you mentioned cap and trade, and I think you hear this so much in the news. You hear people talk about cap and trade, and you hear about pricing carbon, but I think the average person doesn't even understand what that means. Can you back up just a little bit and help explain cap and trade and how this whole idea of putting a price on carbon helps level the playing field?
There's cap and trade, and other places have used a carbon tax. Basically, the cap and trade sets a limit of how much carbon can be released, and you have to comply with that. But if you can't, as a business owner, if you can't reduce it to a certain point right away, you can buy other people's credits who have done that and use that as part of your obligation to reduce your overall carbon footprint. So there becomes a market in these carbon credits. and they will vary in price based on the supply and demand. But what it does is it once and for all says to companies that, okay, this is what you have to get to. And whether you reduce your own carbon or you buy credits, you know, you can do both, but there is a economic activity and a cost to this that you have to deal with. So instead of externalizing all these costs of carbon in terms of global warming or pollution, particulates in the case of some emissions, it's all put into a trading system. And then a carbon tax would just say, okay, if your business generates a certain amount of carbon, you're going to have to pay a tax on that. So all of a sudden your business got a lot more expensive, and so your incentive is to reduce the amount of carbon you generate.
And Nancy, is it only on major manufacturing and major energy companies, or would it really embrace all kinds of companies?
It depends on where you're looking at this, but certainly in California, it's far beyond, oil companies. They are one of the big generators, but also utilities, the cement industry, it really is pretty comprehensive. It's just that as in any industrial scenario, you have some winners and some losers, and the losers are the ones that, you know, have huge carbon footprints and haven't really done anything about it. But that what the cap and trade does is give them time, and because it's not like you're breaking the law if you don't comply, if you can't get your carbon down in right away. You have a way to do that, which is to buy someone else's credits. So it's a less kind of invasive type of approach, which is why a lot of people like it.
So to me, the way I look at things is that if you look at a chart of coal and natural gas and wind and solar, coal is this unbelievable resource. It's cheap. It has good power output. However, it doesn't take into account the fact that you have these greenhouse gas emissions, you have water use, you have problems. The Governor Schweitzer in Montana several years ago said in his State of the State, and unbeknownst to his staffers or anything, he just announced, I need a transmission line right across the state of Montana because we have a coal burning state, and this is horrible emissions for our state. And so it just seems like such a simple equation that this is a great resource, but without technology to help capture those and without the incorporation of these other resources, we're all going to be spending a lot more money in healthcare and all of these other issues. But that message that looks pretty simple to me, it doesn't seem to get out there. And even in the presidential debates with Romney and Obama, what Romney said was that Obama spent more in the past over his term than all of oil and gas subsidies. That's just wrong. And so how do we get that message out there?
Well, again, it has to do with getting these companies to mature and accumulate some size and some political clout. We have to remember that coal and oil have been around for a long time. And when industries have succeeded over decades or even centuries, they amass a huge amount of political capital. They spend lots of money lobbying. They have many more people, many, many more resources than the upstarts. While solar and wind capture a lot of the hearts and minds of many Americans, they're still small. They don't have the PR budgets or lobbying budgets that the big companies have that have been around for a while. There's no reason to think they would. But that creates an inequality. And so it's kind of a David and Goliath scenario that will take time to kind of make equal. But what can we do? We can continue to voice our support for an alternative future no one's saying kill the coal industry. I mean, that's not the point at all. It's use coal in an appropriate way, but don't use it without preventing the kind of environmental and health impacts that are not positive for our country, because we end up paying for those, as you mentioned, in the long run. So it really has to do with giving a new form of energy that doesn't have these negative effects, giving them policies to and nurturing them. And then the people in those in the new industries really have to be out there and spend time educating people as to the value of what they do. And that will help a lot. And certainly when you start to create jobs, then all of a sudden you've got huge political capital. So it's a little bit of this industry is young. It needs to develop some of the same effective practices that the incumbents have over the many years they've been in business.
Absolutely, Nancy. And when we come back, we'll delve deeper into some of those practices. We'll be looking more at new energy opportunities, and we'll return here in just a minute. More with Nancy Fund when we return.
You're listening to Driving Force Radio, presented by ICOSA. Once again, here's your host, Jen Mazzotti.
Welcome back to Driving Force Radio. Today we're doing Energy 101, and it's a fantastic show. My guest host today is Kelly De La Torre, the founder and CEO of Rapid Tech Transit, based here in Denver, Colorado. Welcome to the show, Kelly.
Thanks, Jen.
And our guest today is Nancy Fun, the managing partner of DBL Investors based out of San Francisco. And we've had this fascinating talk about what's going on in green jobs and green energy around the country. And as we exited the last segment, we were talking a lot about traditional sources of technology, oil and gas, coal, things like that. And that we're not, that clean energy, green energy is not necessarily talking about decimating traditional energy sources, but really trying to find that way to get everybody to work together. And so, Kelly, I'm going to let you go ahead and jump right back in with Nancy about this conversation.
We're not advocating on this show that we need to kill coal. And in fact, we talk on this show quite a lot about we need all of our energy sources. And so we just want to be clear that that's not what we're talking about here. Nancy, though, in the report, a frequent argument against clean energy is that it is killing coal jobs. And you say that there are 136,000 coal jobs, but you take pains in the report to note that there are a lot more clean energy jobs. Can you talk a little bit about why you put that into the report and what was the impetus behind that?
Well, we were just trying to frame the comparison with the size of the workforce, and there are states that have clean tech jobs that are far bigger than that 136,000 of coal jobs. And while certainly coal has a lot of other jobs that it results in, called the multiplier effect, so that it's more than just the 136,000 on the website, our point was to show that already clean tech has more of an impact on jobs than coal. And that's not surprising because it's growing. You know, the costs of solar and wind are coming down every year, whereas they're really going up for coal because of all of the regulatory overhead that you have to put on coal. So the dynamic is very different. And going forward, we're going to see these renewable sources have a far more significant impact on creating jobs than coal.
And actually, that impact on job creation, as we talked about in the last segment, it's not a partisan issue, but it's recognized on both sides of the aisle. And to demonstrate, you highlight in the report five Republican governors. These governors, like Haley Barbour of Mississippi, Sam Brownback of Kansas, Chris Christie in New Jersey, and Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, Texas Governor Rick Perry. These Republican governors are recognizing the importance of clean energy in their strategies for their states and have grown these industries significantly during their terms. Can you talk a little bit about what those governors are doing?
Sure. Let me just start by saying that, of course, there are many, many Democratic governors that are doing the same thing. And so we didn't mean to imply that Democrats were somehow not with the program. Of course they are. It's just not that surprising. I mean, because people feel that this is kind of an issue that Democrats connect with more readily than Republicans, although in this report we hope we've shown that's not necessarily the case. So don't mean to diminish the Democratic governors out there. They're doing, a lot of them are doing fantastic work. And there are even more Republican governors that are also doing a lot. We just decided to focus on five. And in fact, this is the way the report, the idea for the report came about was we have a company that makes energy efficient electrochromic windows that dim and lighten based on heat and sunlight. So they really are aesthetically very pleasing for those big glass buildings or even homes and sunroofs and things like that. But they're also, they reduce your heating and cooling bill significantly because they keep out the sun when it's too hot and such. And they avoid the use of blinds and things. And so when we made that investment, I was very surprised that Haley Barber of Mississippi put together a very attractive long-term loan package to attract the manufacturing plant of this company, Solidyne, to Mississippi. And because I thought, wow, Haley Barber is one of the deans of the Republican Party. I mean, he's just very well regarded, and he is not at all towing the party line here in terms of being suspicious of clean tech and his jobs. He's actually courting clean tech, and it turns out he put together some incentive packages that resulted in five or six companies. I'm not sure of the exact number, but deciding to put their facilities in Mississippi, and he wrapped some workforce training dollars around that, and he's really working to diversify the state's economy in a post-Katrina era, and really have more options for his citizens. So I thought, again, getting back to our earlier discussion, this is what governors do. They look, they need to look out for their residents and help them thrive. And so successful. And when he left office, termed out, he enjoyed some of the highest ratings of any politician in the country. So must be working for him is what I think. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback is another interesting fellow. He has, at the Republican convention, I mean, all of these politicians get into the electoral fray, and you can't blame them. But he has, because wind is quite a significant employer in Kansas, he has been very vocal in his support for the production tax credit. In fact, he spoke at the annual meeting of the American Wind Energy Association back in June and very explicitly called for the renewal of the PTC. And he's written editorials in the Wichita paper. I mean, he's been very, very vocal. So again, not your Sunday talk show bashing of clean tech Republican that we've been witnessing in kind of the Washington scenario. Another governor that we looked at was Chris Christie from New Jersey, who of course had was rumored to be a VP selection, and is one of the stars in the Republican Party, may run for higher office someday. Those are the rumors. And again, he helped sign his legislature has been quite supportive of renewables, and so he doesn't, it's not like he's coming up with all of the ideas, but it takes a governor to sign these laws and to help enforce them and develop those policies. And he's been very good at that. In fact, in July, he signed a bill that called for a certain percentage of power from utilities to come from renewables, which is one of the building blocks of state renewables policies. And when he signed it, he had a great quote, which we put in the paper, which was basically, having renewable energy as part of our energy portfolio is not a Democratic or Republican issue. It's an issue that we all need to work on together.
Right. And I like how you talked about Chris Christie, because I am a big fan of New Jersey. I went to law school there, and I'm a big fan of what Chris Christie has been doing, in that he's been very targeted in his legislation and targeted at moving some of these market barriers to development. So, for example, one recent piece of legislation that he signed was to fix the barrier for municipal buildings to invest in energy efficiency and renewable energies, and so that they can now take advantage of these energy savings. So he has done a great job in building that in his state. But what also I don't think people may not recognize is the depth of job creation by introducing a lot of these new technologies. When a new technology is first released, it's not going to be in its most perfect state. And so there are all these, all kinds of spin-off technologies that happen as that first original technology matures. And so there are tons of jobs created out of that, a lot of jobs in our national laboratories, a lot of jobs in our universities. And this is exactly what our states do well, because they know exactly the talent that they have in their states. Could you comment on that a little bit?
Right. And that, again, that's what states do so well. They are able to wrap together employment programs, training, transition programs. The PUC, the Public Utilities Commission in these states, has played a vital role working to get other parts of the regulatory framework put together to support these initiatives. It's not surprising that in a huge country like ours that states are some of the early adopters. We just now need to kind of kick the ball into the federal zone and try to get some more sustainable policies that don't disappear, Cinderella at the ball.
It paints a great picture, Nancy. Also in the report, you provide some recommendations for some policy initiatives at the federal level. They're not actually new initiatives. One is keep the solar investment tax credit. One's redraft tax legislation affecting clean tech related master limited partnerships, and also for solar REITs, and also extend the production tax credit, which we've talked a little bit about. Could you go into a little more detail on those?
Sure. And because, again, there are lots of other policies that could be helpful. So again, we picked some governors, we didn't mean to imply that there aren't other important policies, and certainly renewable portfolio standards at the federal level, which is what New Jersey just passed, what we were just talking about, that could be very useful as well. But we didn't talk about that. We talked about some of the ones that are on people's minds. Certainly the production tax credit for wind, which we've referred to many times in this show, is numero uno, because it's the most pressing. It's going to expire at the end of the year if Congress doesn't do something about it. The other two that we spoke to, one is relating to, and I don't want to get into the weeds because people can go offline and look up what a master limited partnership and what solar REITs are all about. Basically, these are financing mechanisms that reduce the cost of capital for renewables, and they do it in terms of the way that the corporation is organized and the tax burden that it has. We're all familiar with REITs for real estate. This would just say that solar panels are a real asset and can be included in that financing structure. And similarly with master limited partnerships, these are ways to organize project activity that has less of a tax burden. And they've been used, the MLPs as they're called, they've been a key tool in building out our energy infrastructure. They've been used a lot in oil and gas pipelines and various parts of the traditional energy economy. But the laws were written, solar and wind don't get that ability to use an MLP structure. And when these laws were written, no one was thinking about solar and wind. So it's not that surprising. But it is a unlevel playing field, and both MLPs and solar REITs would help to give more people the opportunity to invest in renewables projects. Because right now, it's done mainly through private sources and investment tax credits and such, corporations and banks. And so we need more accessible ways to finance solar and wind and energy efficiency and other renewables that bring down the cost of capital. Because as much as the reduction in price of panels over the past couple of years has helped to make solar more accessible, if you reduce the financing cost, you're going to have another breakthrough in terms of adoption, because it's that important. So much of solar is based on the cost of finance rather than the technical aspects of the product.
So, Nancy, it sounds like there's a clear need to redraft tax legislation for master limited partnerships and solar REITs, but the report notes that we should also renew the solar investment tax credit. Can you explain to the listeners what the importance is of the solar investment tax credit to the industry?
The ITC is set to expire in 2016. So while it's not a crisis, it's something we should start paying attention to right now and figure out what the right approach is. And the investment tax credit has really been behind the solar leases and the PPAs, and those financing approaches have been responsible for the increase in adoption of solar. In the case of solar leases, it took away that huge upfront cost of solar for a homeowner and turned it into a monthly lease payment that was less than the power bill that a homeowner used to pay. So it really took something quite intimidating and made it a no-brainer in many cases, depending on your energy bill and how much energy you use. And the way that the ITC has helped that is that the leases are funded through tax equity funds, where they bundle up all of the incentives, the tax credits, and the company that puts up the money for the fund, they develop a partnership with a solar company, and then they derive the benefit of that tax credit, which helps to reduce their own tax bill. And so it's a financing mechanism where they aggregate all those savings, and it benefits them, and the consumer benefits by getting the money to put in the solar, or and then just paying over time like you do a mortgage. So it's a win-win, and it wouldn't exist without the ITC. And what people often don't give adequate credit to is that it's not just the ITC. The private capital has come in many more times what the actual government tax credit is costing. So, and that's a very important point, because what better public policy can you have than to spur a new energy adoption that's cost effective for its users and brings in lots of private capital rather than just relying only on the government capital. So it's proven, it's been working, and it expires in a few years. And so we need to decide, are we going to continue the tax credit? And if we are, it should be for a longer time, because we can't have the stop-start mentality. If we are going to continue it, maybe we should, I mean, some people feel that we should decrease it over time. You know, let's extend it for the next 12 years or 10 years, but have it go down gradually over time. That's what a lot of the rebate programs that the states have done. The California Solar Initiative started with one rebate many years ago and now has a very small one, because the adoption curve has matured. We don't really take a view as to what the right answer is, but I want to remind people of what we were talking about a few minutes ago. Let's not assume we have to cut this thing cold turkey, because we don't do that for other energy sources. You know, it's not like we're taking away some of the tax provisions in coal or in oil that have helped to build those industries to be so strong. You know, we've never done that, and I don't think it's ever been on anyone's political agenda until quite recently. And so if we're going to reduce some incentives for renewables, we have to do it for energy writ large, for oil, for nuclear, for coal, and not focus on the newest entrant. That just is not smart policy.
Well, Nancy, and beyond policy, DBL Investors plays a big role, particularly with your double bottom line philosophy, in supporting these technologies and getting to market, which means, of course, that you're really dialed in. Can you talk about the trends that you're seeing in clean tech?
Well, again, we're seeing from the states, we're seeing some policies that encourage, for example, storage. You know, certainly if you have more renewables in your power mix, you have more variability, and you have certain limitations, you know, if the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. And so storage is a good answer to kind of backing up and firming some of those resources. It's been expensive in the past, and the good news is that a lot of companies out there are finally cracking the code, and while it's not ready for massive prime time yet, over the next few years, you're definitely going to see batteries, flow batteries, different approaches to storage that will make it cheaper and make it distributed, as well as being able to support big solar farms or solar plants. So, and you're seeing some states develop incentives for storage, just as they have for renewables. And so that may be something that picks up steam as those technologies become more cost effective. And I someone has introduced, maybe it's Senator Wyden, I'm not sure, but there is a draft of a bill to develop kind of an ITC for storage as well. So that's one example of what's happening. And then of course with the smart grid, you're going to be allowing people to eventually turn off, turn on their power when necessary, and some of the time of use pricing that rewards people for using power when it's not at peak demand. Those are all going to help with the energy profile. And then of course we have this huge variable, completely new, which is the emergence of electric vehicles, which are going to both, drive more demand for electricity, so utilities like that, but at the same time put more options for our grid, because eventually there may be two-way sending up, you know, both charging your battery and sending back your electricity when necessary. There's a huge correlation between people that buy electric cars and people that install solar, because one of the first things you do when you get an electric car is think about your electricity bill, and you begin to say, okay, well, where's my electricity coming now that I've unhinged myself from the gas pump? And if it isn't a clean source, then you say, well, gee, I'd like to make it cleaner. And so there are a lot of good things that happen when people start driving electric cars in terms of their consciousness, their awareness of their energy footprint. And that all is good news for renewables.
So, Nancy, on ICOSA here, we talk a lot about connect and collaborate and what the consumer can do to get involved. So if there is a listener out there that is really interested in this conversation, what would you recommend that they do to get involved in this conversation about clean technology and renewable energy?
Great question. It's so important to hear from people that are concerned about our nation's energy future and want to do something about it. And of course, one of the best things you can do is to walk the walk and see if in your own life, in your own household, in your own transportation, you can reduce your carbon footprint. But going back to what we said a few minutes ago, it's also important to make your voice heard, because as we discussed, the incumbent industries understandably have big budgets, have lots of people telling their story. I mean, they're doing TV commercials, they're in Washington. And so the new renewables economy is not as well organized and isn't as, doesn't have as many resources. But you can make a big difference writing op-eds, joining with various civic or environmental groups in your state or your neighborhood, and really just figuring out ways to educate people and spread the word that there is an alternative and that it has a vital role to play in our future.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Nancy. You have so much knowledge in this area with your work with these emerging companies, your work with policy, and then also I was very excited to meet you at the MIT Clean Education and Empowerment Symposium in Boston. So we're excited that you came on the show, and we're especially thrilled that you shared all of your knowledge with our listeners here today and the importance of the consumer getting involved.
Well, thank you both. Thanks for taking the time, and really enjoyed this, and let's look forward to a sustainable future together.
Definitely, Nancy. Thank you so much. And Jan, I want to also mention, because I'm so excited about it, and it's particularly applicable in light of this show, is that we're having our first ever Women in Energy event up in Fort Collins on November 15th. And to find out more information about that, you can go to www.wie-womeninenergy.com. And to look at my website, you can go to rapidtechtranzit.com. And to find out more about Nancy and DBL Investors, go to www.dblinvestors.com.
And Kelly, every single time we do the show, I just love doing it with you. I love the guests that we're able to interview and talk to.
And we're very excited about this show. We're excited that we talked about how important it is for the consumer to get involved and how important it is to our clean tech industry, to our environment, and to our kids. So thank you very much for joining us, and we will see you on the next ICOSA Driving Force Radio.
And join us every Saturday from 10 to 11 on Driving Force Radio on AM KNUS. Thank you, and have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Driving Force Radio with ICOSA, hosted by Jan Mazzotti. ICOSA invites you to do something different. Be a driving force. Influence change. Be a leader. Visit us at theicosamagazine.com.